Welcome to Put a Shrimp on It.
Wait, no, that's my line.
The Barbie podcast where we are a girl like you.
Oh wait, you're stealing both lines from me. I'm a Barbie girl in the Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic. You can brush my hair, undress me everywhere.
Imagination, life is your creation. Come on Barbie, let's go party. Welcome to Put a Shrimp on It. If this is your first time here, I'm Philomena.
And I'm Jason.
This is a allegedly monthly review show.
Yeah. Of very allegedly.
of every CGI animated Barbie movie made since the year 2001.
Mm-hmm.
On this episode, we are going to be reviewing the 2004 Barbie film, Barbie as the Princess and the Pauper.
Mm. Before we do, we should talk about like the lovely Tumblr message that we got sent.
The lovely Tumblr message that we got sent. I have it saved on my desktop as our first fan mail.
It is, though.
What I learned recently is that Tumblrs that have more than one moderator can receive fan mail, unlike Tumblrs that are just a single moderator or a side blog. Because we are a side blog that has more than one moderator, I guess they just never turned off fan mail for us, even though nobody's been able to use fan mail since like 2012 or something.
Oh my god, found a way to hack Tumblr.
So the message reads, "Hi, I'm in love with your podcast, and I'm just wondering when you guys expect to put up a new episode. I don't mean to be pressuring. I just really love your guys' content. I might sound silly, but your podcast means a lot to me. Your combination of Barbie movies and film and literature knowledge is a rare find, and it makes my week. Also, as a Jewish woman, to hear you care and make a point about the anti-Semitic tropes in Swan Lake and Western folklore in general is extremely special for me. Sending you both love, Furby Taxidermy."
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say, we love you too, Furby Taxidermy. We love you too.
Yeah. I really love that message, and I love the person that sent it. I'm really glad you cared about our tiny, like, really silly show that I'm surprised has one fan, let alone more than one. Because Mina,
yeah,
I told you about this a bit, but one of my classmates actually listened to our show and was like, "Oh, I really like this show. I really enjoy listening to it." And she genuinely does enjoy listening to it. And I'm like, wow, why?
That makes my heart happy.
Just, why do you like listening to this? I mean, I guess she thinks it's funny. I think it's funny, but I don't expect other people to think it's funny. I have low expectations. But I guess people like this.
So Jason.
Yeah.
We are recording on this, the most hallowed of eves.
Yeah.
October 31st.
Yeah. Not September.
Not September 31st, because September 31st doesn't exist, but indeed, October 31st, also known here in Canada land as Halloween.
Well, I think America as well, and probably a few other places.
Probably a few other places. Now, Jason, what would you say is the scariest thing about Barbie as the Princess and the Pauper?
I would say the anti-Semitism.
The anti-Semitism. Sure. True. What I was going to say was compulsory heterosexuality.
Oh, that's also a big one. There's also capitalism.
Oh, yes.
Exploitation of the workers.
Seize the means, eat the rich.
Yeah. By the way, remember how we were meant to record this in spring and we didn't?
Life happened to me, Jason.
Yep.
Life happened to me.
It does. Mostly to you.
Mostly to me, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Barbie as the Princess and the Pauper is the topic of today's episode, is our most joyous focus.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason, I don't know if you know this, but the novel that this movie is based on, The Prince and the Pauper, something that I did not know before I was doing the research for this episode, is that Mark Twain is a pseudonym.
What?
Yeah, Mark Twain is not the dude's name.
What is? Dead silence while Mina looks it up.
Sorry, I forgot to write it down. His real name is Samuel Langhorne Clemens.
Oh, well, I can see why he would go with Mark Twain. That's a real mouthful.
Yeah, his real name is Samuel Langhorne Clemens. So Mark Twain is generally considered to be one of the great American authors. But I'm really not entirely sure why he decided to write a novel about the Tudors. I really don't know.
I mean, is it... Did you read the whole thing?
I did not read the whole thing.
I did not read the whole thing either. I started, like, reading, and then, like, 10 chapters in, I stopped. So, yeah, it's a really long book.
Children did not have much to do back then.
Yeah. I mean, are we gonna do a narration? I don't think we are we?
What do you mean?
I mean, the book is, like, 70,000 words long. We're not gonna narrate the whole thing.
Oh, no. No, no, no. I was just going to do, like, that first little bit.
Oh, are you going to do that now?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to sit here and wait then.
Okay. In the ancient city of London, on a certain autumn day in the second quarter of the 16th century, a boy was born to a poor family of the name of Canty, who did not want him. On the same day, another English child was born to a rich family of the name of Tudor, who did want him. All England wanted him too. England had so longed for him, and hoped for him, and prayed God for him, that now that he was really come, the people went nearly mad for joy. Mere acquaintances hugged and kissed each other and cried. Everybody took a holiday, and high and low, rich and poor, feasted and danced and sang, and got very mellow. And they kept this up for days and nights together. By day, London was a sight to see, with gay banners waving from every balcony and housetop, and splendid pageants marching along. By night, it was again a sight to see, with its great bonfires at every corner, and its troops of revelers making merry around them. There was no talk in all England but of this new baby, Edward Tudor, Prince of Wales, who lay lapped in silks and satins, unconscious of all this fuss, and not knowing that great lords and ladies were tending him and watching over him, and not caring either. But there was no talk about the other baby, Tom Canty, lapped in his poor rags, except among the family of paupers, whom he had just come to trouble with his presence. So we get that sort of same narration from Barbie.
Yeah.
As it were, in this one.
Yeah, but the thing is, okay, I have something to point out already. The movie has narration at the start. The menu in the DVD version also has narration.
Yeah.
And in the credits of IMDb, Heather Haley is credited as the voice actor that did the narration, but I'm pretty sure it's Kelly Sheridan, isn't it?
It is Kelly Sheridan, yeah.
So why, I don't understand why Heather Haley has been credited for the narration.
Oh, right. Yeah, Jason, I don't know either. That confused me too. I sort of just ignored her on the IMDb page.
Yeah, I was like, who is this woman? Why is she here? Like, is this a mistake that IMDb did? Was there another narration that we didn't get to see, like a secret egg narration?
Maybe. I don't know. Oh, you know what? Maybe she's one of the voices in the bloopers.
Oh. Yeah, maybe she's the director in the bloopers.
Yeah.
Okay, that would make sense.
Okay. So, the film opens with this shot of two butterflies fluttering across the screen, and they're like pink and blue.
Yeah, a blue one and a pink one. Very recurring theme.
It's a recurring theme. I did some Googling, Jason. And
oh boy.
Apparently butterflies are actually really closely associated with the resurrection of Christ.
Wait, what?
Because of the metamorphosis.
Okay. Where is this going?
Well, all I'm saying, Jason, is that we continue to find Christian biblical themes recurring
in
these movies.
Oh my God. Yes. On the very same day, two girls were immaculately conceived in the same kingdom.
Anyway, so Barbie narrates, Kelly Sheridan as Barbie narrates the story of the birth of Princess Annalise and Erica.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know more about the kingdom that the girls are from.
Yeah, me too.
Because we've got Dulcinea for Dominic. But we never get the name of the place they're actually in. And we also don't get any last names for anybody, except for Preminger. Like, we don't have a first name for Preminger, even.
Preminger, Jewish person. That's his name.
Jude Preminger.
I think the IMDb page mentioned something about what the land that the princess was from was called.
I don't think it did.
Well, let's just call it Kingdom Land. How about that?
I've taken to, in my fanfictions, calling it Arborea.
Oh.
After one of
By the way, good plug, Mina. Nice segue to a plug, Mina. Jesus Christ.
Dulcinea, or rather, okay, so Dulcinea is the way that Bismarck says it. It should actually be pronounced Dulcinea or Dulcinea, because it's a Spanish word. In Don Quixote, the name of one of the women that he is pursuing is Dulcinea, or rather, a name that he gives her is Dulcinea.
I thought it was called Dulcinea because of the dulcimer, because King Dominic plays the dulcimer.
No, okay. So, fun fact, same word. So the word dolce means sweet in Italian, and it comes from the same Latin root. So Dulcinea means like sweet one or sweetheart or sweet woman, and then dulcimer is sweet sounding.
I see. That makes sense.
I have more to yell about how the instruments that Dominic plays later. I have more to yell about that. Anyway, in a village high on a mountaintop, two baby girls are born. So we get to see Annalise in her crib, swaddled up. And then we get to see her being held by Queen Genevieve and her husband that doesn't have a name. And guess who?
Who's the character model? Rapunzel? Yeah.
Yeah. So Mainframe continues to reuse assets in this film.
Yep.
So I wish that they would have given us a young Genevieve, and I wish that they would have given us, like, a real dad for Annalise, because, like, obviously he's dead or something at the point of the narrative, but
yeah,
I feel as though they could have used a character model and then, like, reused that character model later.
Oh, like for one of the background characters.
No, I don't even mean like that. I mean, like, they could have done a really pretty detailed model for the movie and then used the really pretty detailed model in a different movie later on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but, Mina, if they'd done that, there wouldn't be enough money for all the gay scenes. So, what's the priority here? Do we want to give, like, a dad that is a different model? Or do we just want to, like, have gay singing?
True, valid. And then, okay, so, and then we move to Erica, whose parents are Marie from Swan Lake and the Stefan Daniel Eric model.
Yeah, Prince Eric, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just like, neither of them look anything like her.
I know.
Now, I'm not saying that I know anything about 3D animation. I haven't touched Blender since, like, 2010.
I love how you think that 3D animation is Blender. Like, this is the program that 3D animators use a lot.
Well, okay, I don't know what they would have been using. I don't know what Mainframe would have used, you know, in 2004. Anyway, I just feel like it wouldn't have taken that much money. Like, it wouldn't have taken that long.
I mean, back then, maybe it would have.
Maybe, I guess. Ugh, Mattel, why didn't you give Mainframe more money to make these movies? Gosh darn it, Mattel. Ugh. Anyway, all I'm saying is that Dragon Age Origins started development in 2002, and, like, the technology was there to make models that are toolkitted.
Are you trying to associate this Bob movie with Dragon Age as well?
No, not at, like, a narrative level, but I'm saying both of them are, like, 3D rendered, right? So, obviously, the motion capture that they do for the Barbie movies is amazing, but I feel like the models really suffer. Anyway, Erica's parents being dirt poor is canon accurate to the original P&P novel, but... Yeah.
But they didn't beat her.
Yeah, the fact that they love her is obviously beautiful and wonderful, but it's not entirely accurate. I think that Madame Carp steps in as a really good analog there, though. Mm. So there is some retention of that in the narrative of Princess and the Pauper.
I've written here, the princess is levitating.
Yes!
In all caps.
They didn't render the bottom of her dress. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, is that in the song? No, that's not in the song. That's in the narration. So, during the narration, the two protagonists, Erica and Annalise, are standing on balconies facing each other. And on Annalise's side, her legs are, like, cut off at the balcony. So, like, there's a small hole.
There's a space between the railings.
Yeah. And, you can't see her legs, so she's hovering above that space. I'm not sure how that happened animation-wise. Did they just cut off her legs and they didn't show? Like, did they have her sitting down?
I think what must have happened was it would have taken longer to render the full model, so they just cut the skirt off of it And then...
They just cut off her feet.
Yeah.
That's so macabre.
Something that I noticed is that the architecture of the castle is, like, eerily similar to the architecture of the Canadian Parliament buildings.
Yeah. You mentioned that before.
Which I did show you. But if you go and look at a picture of the Canadian House of Commons, and then you go and you look at a picture of the castle from Barbie as the Princess and the Pauper, it's uncannily similar, and I think I know why.
Yeah, it's like a Canadian studio animating it, isn't it?
It is! Mainframe is a production company out of Vancouver, British Columbia in Canada. They're on the West Coast.
Mm.
So a lot of the voice actors in this movie especially are Canadian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel like before we move on, it would be a really good time to very quickly talk about the writers of this movie.
Oh, okay. Who are they? I haven't written them down.
No, exactly. So it's Cliff Ruby and Alana Lesser who are the writers on this movie. From my research... From my subterfuge on the internet, it seems like they're married or perhaps life partners.
Wait, the two of them together?
Yeah. They have written many beloved children's films, including Balto, which is a particular childhood favorite of mine. The first one is all about, like, the actual story of, like, an actual dog that took medicine across the very far north and was a very good doggy, very good pup. Very good puppo. The sequels are kind of esoteric, but that's fine. Anyway, the two of them also wrote Rapunzel, Swan Lake, and a couple of other classic Barbie movies. They worked alongside Owen Hurley as the director, and Owen Hurley also directed Nutcracker, Swan Lake, and Rapunzel.
Jesus.
The two of them did not write on the Nutcracker. There are five people who wrote on the Nutcracker, and none of those five people are Alana Lesser or Cliff Ruby. They are, in fact, Linda Engelspine, Ruth Handler, Hilary Hinkle, E.T.A. Hoffman, and Rob Hudnut, whose name
sounds like that. Are you retroactively adding info for our previous episodes that we forgot to mention?
Yes, I am. Rob Hudnut's name sounds like that one guy from How to Train Your Dragon. Anyway, so we get some more Kelly Sheridan narration over the mine. And Jason, now you can talk.
Okay, so we see a picture of the mine. It's a still picture. And then it starts, like, animating. The queen is at the mine, and a miner comes out with, like, a mine cart, and there's almost nothing in it. And she's like, oh! And the narration goes, the widowed queen was shocked. And and she's like, oh no, with no gold, the kingdom will, like, die, and people will have to leave, and we'll all be poor. And then it cuts to, like, the palace, as the narration says, if only she could call on her trusted advisor for help. And it's like this picture of Preminger that we see that for some reason the castle has. And there's like evil music playing while like this is shown. So I have two questions for that. One, why is there a picture of her advisor in like Annalise's room? Or wherever they are when this is happening.
I really don't know.
Would you do that as a regent?
I don't know if I would. I mean, are we assuming that we're still married or have we gotten divorced at this point?
Oh. we're definitely still married and I'm dead.
Oh, no. Okay.
I mean, you wouldn't, would you? You wouldn't, like, this isn't the Dragon Prince. You wouldn't put, like, a portrait of your advisor in your castle for no reason. Like, you wouldn't.
No. You know what I think? I think that Preminger had that picture commissioned and then planted it.
And nobody noticed. I wonder how this got here and then never bothered to remove it.
Huh. I must have had that commissioned at some point. Oh, well.
Anyway, so then the narration is like, oh, but there's this neighboring kingdom with, like, a king that's very young. And
nearby lived a rich young king who was seeking a wife. And as we know, every young man with good fortune must be in want of a wife. Because in this house, we stand Jane Austen.
Yeah.
Queen Genevieve turns to her daughter after saying, young king who is seeking a wife. And, like, Annalise just does not look too plussed by that at all.
Yeah. She's like, I don't know about this. This isn't a good idea. Do not want.
I'm not certain. Do not want. And then the next scene is the beginning of the first song. Yeah. Barbie's first song in her first movie musical.
Yeah.
Annalise, she has a speech at the Historical Society, then a tea at the Horticultural Society, then her math lessons, her geography lessons, her science lessons, and I can only assume he keeps going on after the song starts.
Now I fear I'll never be.
So, Free is primarily a critique on the strictures put on Annalise by her life as a princess, but also by Erica's life being in debt, you know? Yep. And there's a certain sense of vapidness that comes from complaining about having wealth, but we do have to remember that Annalise is, like, about to be in an arranged marriage, and, like, she's allowed to not want to do that.
Yeah.
But yes. So, I mean, it's pretty apt. It's pretty on the nose. You know what I mean? Like, there's a literal indentured servant as half of the duet in this song. So, like, just a little bit on the nose.
You know what's also on the nose? The fact that Barbie's wearing a wedding dress while singing to another, like, woman, and they're both talking about freedom and marrying who they choose. Yeah.
Yes, it is. It's pretty on the nose.
Yeah, that's how queer reading.
We are going to read this movie as Annalise and Erica shipping. You know, we've got the shipping goggles on already. Oh,
can I complain about that for a bit?
Yes, go ahead.
I don't think this movie is as gay as I would have expected it to be.
You're right. Upon rewatching it, the actual content is pretty heterosexual. Yeah. And I mean, the relationships in the movie are all really cute and nice.
Yeah, they are.
But at the same time,
Erica and Annalise are like, literally everyone ships them. Like, there's a lot of people that ship those two characters, but they really only have one scene where they talk to each other.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of shared screen time, which is why I think that there's a lot of opportunity there to write speculative fan fiction about their relationship. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
You're like those Tumblr memes about making fun of canon and being like, I don't care about the canon. This is my stuff now.
My city now.
Anyway, go on about the song.
So Annalise's first verse in this piece, the lyrics are primarily about the more superficial stuff, right? So she sort of breaks in to her critique of her life by starting with the stuff that's kind of obvious, you know, like nobody really wants to go to meetings, you know, nobody really likes to be told what to do, right? And the same thing sort of happens with Erica, where she talks about her work. They both sort of begin their deconstruction at the top, which is great, which is it's a good thing that they're doing that. But as the song continues, you know, Annalise's line, I'm realizing that every present comes with strings.
Yes, I love that line. Like, I love that line a lot.
I love that line so much. I think that's a really important line when you're talking about her character, because it really does sort of give you everything, right? It's every single moment of Annalise's life. She is judged constantly. Mm-hmm. Nothing she ever does will be free from, like, a trickle down, like a ripple, like international intrigue and scandal. Yeah. And then Erica, as Erica moves further through the song, it becomes more about her parents too, right? It becomes more about her dreams.
And her labor.
And her labor, yes. I'm just a real sucker for, like, women talking about the things that they want out of life and, like, making plans to achieve them.
Yeah, me too.
So Jason, what was your vibe on the song?
Okay, so I have a lot of things.
Vibe check!
Oh, Jesus. I can't believe you did that whole setup just to do a vibe check thing. I'm gonna have to put a sound effect of, like, you hitting me and, like, smashing something or something like that. So my notes start off when the servant comes in. I've written down here that the panicking servant is voiced by Colin Murdoch, who's also very prolific and who's also been in a few other Barbie movies. We'll keep an eye out for him to see where else
he is. We'll keep an ear out for him.
Yeah. And I've written down here, giant list fall gag, because he takes out this paper scroll and unfurls it, listing out all the activities that Annalise has to go through the day. It just falls down and rolls under his feet. I'm just going to talk a lot about everything in that, like, in those few moments, if you don't mind. Can I?
Yeah.
Then we see Annalise's cat, who has makeup on for some reason in this movie.
Serafina!
Who is voiced by Kathleen Barr, so she's still here.
Yeah, Kathleen Barr's first speaking credit in the film does actually occur in this song when
Bertie sings
the line,
"Can I come along?
Can I come along?"
Yeah.
That's Kathleen Barr's first voice credit. She voices two characters, Bertie and Serafina, Annalise's cat.
Yeah. So, like you mentioned, we've cut to the song moves to from Annalise singing about, you know, getting married to Erica singing about like her slave labor working as a seamstress.
Yeah.
And like, I have to crochet like 1,000 gosh darn wedding gowns. And Bertie's like, oh, Madame Carp. And this is one of my favorite lines in the film that the villain has.
Yeah.
Where Madame Carp, who's this like, this is a connection with Studio Ghibli. So the with where Madame Carp is the hat owner that is like abusing her workers.
Oh, in Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah, yeah. The hat shop in Howl's Moving Castle. That's what it reminded me of a lot. So. Mm-hmm.
I think you might be thinking about the Witch of the Wastes when you say the hat
shop
owner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know that Sophie's mom runs the shop, but imagine if the witch ran it instead.
Okay.
Can I say what I wanted to say about her, though?
Yes.
So Madame Carp is voiced by Pam Hyatt.
Hyatt.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly.
Pam Hyatt.
Hyatt, okay. Yeah, she's also very prolific in a few other Barbie movies.
She is!
Yeah, and she has this really funny line where she comes in down the stairs and she's like, "What, you think I'm running here? A cabaret?" And it's really funny because cabaret is like the singing bar place.
Yes,
you know?
I do know.
She and Erica have this like back and forth where Erica is like, I would say more like a debtor's prison. And like Madame Carp is like, "Keep laughing. You'll be working for me for another 37 years. And Erica protests saying she's already paid off more than half her debt. And like Madame Carp's like, "Oh, but there's an interest. And your parents shouldn't have borrowed that much if they didn't want you, like, working for me forever without pay." And she's like, "They did it to feed me, you jerk." And Madame Carp's like, "Their mistake." And I'm like, wow, she's such an awful person, but I love her. I really like Madame Carp.
She's an awful person, but she's a good character.
Yeah, exactly. I want to play a D&D character that's like Madame Carp.
Okay, all right.
I really do. It's my fantasy.
Okay, Jason, I want you to guess of Kathleen Barr, Pam Hyatt, and Ellen Kennedy, who plays Queen Genevieve, I want you to guess how many of those people have been in Inuyasha.
All of them?
All of them. The answer to that question is all of them.
So back to the song, Annalise says the words, "And marry whom I choose."
Yes.
And where does the camera go when she says that, Mina?
Well, the camera goes to Erica.
No, it goes to Julian, actually.
Jason, you're so unhelpful.
It goes to Julian! She's
it
looking
does.
Out at
yeah,
the
okay.
gardens at Julian.
Julian, my sweet horticultural son.
I know, right? Anyway, you can keep going.
Kelly Sheridan doesn't do any of the actual singing in this movie. Kelly Sheridan, playing Barbie, playing Annalise and Erica, does not sing as Barbie playing Annalise and Erica. Instead, we get the very talented and wonderful voices of Melissa Lyons, the singing voice for Annalise, and
Julie Stevens.
And we get Julie Stevens, the actress for Erica. I'm going to quickly double back to Melissa Lyons.
Okay.
She is also a, quote, proud member of the Actors Equity Association, SAG-AFTRA, and the Musical Theater Guild in L.A., we stand a proud member of many acting unions.
Mm.
And then Julie Stevens, the actress who voices Erica, her IMDb page is actually primarily made up of roles as a studio teacher.
Oh.
Yeah, so she's the one who, like, teaches the child actors while they're on set.
I see.
So she actually has a lot of really wonderful work on her portfolio website of like her performances in like Wicked and stuff. She has a really wonderful, Melissa Lyons and Julie Stevens both have beautiful voices.
They do.
I can't imagine a world in which, like, having Kelly Sheridan be the voice of Barbie, but then not be the singing voices, or Melissa Lyons and Julie Stevens being the singers but not the voice actors. Like, I feel like they just should have picked one. You know what I mean? Like, Kelly Sheridan doesn't really need to be here. All the important stuff happens during the songs.
Yeah. Can I say something about Kelly Sheridan in this movie?
Yes.
I really enjoy how she makes Erica and Annalise sound different.
Yes. She does a very good job.
She voices both of them. And yes. I really like her deep voice or deeper voice
for
as Erica.
Erica. Yeah.
Yeah. Genuinely, I like women with deep voices.
Oh, do you, Jason?
Yes, Mina. Because they remind me of all the men I can't date. That's not true. I just like women with deep voices for some reason.
What I really want to know is how much of the movie was hand animated and how much of the movie was mocapped, because I found that in the free sequence, there were a lot of like weird animation errors, like necks and chins like intersecting strangely, or like weird physicality. And so I was wondering about how much of it was captured and how much of it was like done from a reference, or how much of it was like automatically generated.
Do you know that gif where Erica goes into the closet while dressed up as Annalise and comes out and like moves her
yes.
hands in like a pattern? I
yes.
feel like that was not mocapped. Yeah, but it's really funny when you say when I come out of the closet in the caption. That's on our blog somewhere. It was a really funny gif.
It was. One section of animation that I really liked in this part was mm-hmm. when Madame Carp comes down the stairs.
Yeah, yeah.
She's like slinking down the stairs and the feathers on her hat are all moving.
Yeah.
That was really good. I really liked that one section.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whoever did the Madame Carp animations, the whole movie, Madame Carp's animations are so good. Like, they're so expressive and like full of emotion. They're just...
Yeah.
Madame Carp was really well animated.
We have a thing for villains.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. So the song ends eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason, do you have anything to say more about the song before we go?
I think it's near the ending or at the ending where Queen Genevieve, Annalise's mom, comes in and she's like, I'm so sorry that I have to like force you to do this, my daughter, but it's vital that you marry King Dominic to like stop the kingdom from like literally dying and everyone
catching
like,
fire.
Yeah, pretty much. I have a note here for the Wikipedia page for the Barbie movies for having all the scripts.
Does it?
Yeah, so the Barbie movies Wikipedia page has, at least for the movies that we've watched so far, has scripts of the movies, and I've had to like reference those scripts to like figure out some of the lyrics because I couldn't hear them properly.
Oh,
so
I was just using
that.
Genius lyrics.
Because in the song, before the strings line, Barbie says, you would think that I'm so lucky that I have so many things. I'm realizing that every present comes with strings. And I couldn't figure out what that first part was, where you would think that I'm so lucky that I have so many things. I couldn't hear that very well. So I went to the wiki for the scripts. Oh, and I have it written down here. When Bertie's like, can I come along to Erica's like, I'm going to be free and like leave this place. I was like, oh yes, Bertie and Erica, the perfect lesbian ship. Like, I feel like
yeah,
that makes more sense.
Yeah, I wonder why more people, I feel like, no. Yeah, do you remember the French guy in The Prince and the Pauper?
No, I don't remember him at all. Like, in the book?
Yeah, in the book. Oh, okay, no, he's not French. He's English. I think he went to war in France. I think that's why I remembered it. So, Miles Hendon
mm-hmm.
is the guy who, like, helps the prince yeah. when the prince is running around as Tom Canty. And I think that Bertie sort of mirrors the character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She does help Annalise. Yeah. I have one final note for the song. Do you have any more notes on the music?
No.
Hey, Mina, do you have any more notes on the music? No, but I've written down here that it's a very nice duet when they say, I close my eyes and feel myself fly 1,000 miles away. I thought that was a very nice
lead. Oh, okay. So I actually do have more notes on the music.
Okay, go on then.
The I close my eyes and find myself flying. That whole, you're going to play it. You're not going to put me singing it in. You're going to play it.
Okay.
I close my eyes and feel myself fly 1,000 miles away. I could take flight, but would it be right? My conscience tells me stay.
So that motif recurs throughout the film.
And I have marked some notable recurrences of that motif later on in the movie.
Mm.
I think that that musical theme, as well as the theme from Girl Like You, they both recur in like different arrangements and variations. And I think that it's really interesting to like rewatch the movie and listen for those recurring themes.
Yeah.
I personally think that the free motif is Erica's motif.
Doesn't it also play when Annalise is denied access to the castle by the guard?
It does, yes.
Do you think it's because the roles are inversed at that point?
I do, yes.
Annalise has Erica's role,
yes,
as the pauper.
Exactly.
And Erica has
You're cottoning on. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that Free is Erica's motif, and I think that Girl Like You is Annalise's motif.
But doesn't Erica sing Girl Like You
They're
more?
Both duets, Jason, but Girl Like You recurs more often with Annalise than it does with Erica.
That's a good point. Okay.
Yeah, I think you can kind of map everybody's songs to each other. I do think that If You Loved Me For Me is the Dominic motif. I'm not entirely certain To Be a Princess is Julian's motif. I think that Julian sort of does share the pauper motif, and that could be because... Go ahead.
I'm just going to say this is just your area, so I can only just nod in approval and be like, yeah, probably, because I was not paying attention to any of the musical motifs. I just noticed that the melody sounded similar to the songs at some parts of the movie.
I mean, you mentioned it earlier, how And Marry Whom I Choose, like, lingers on Julian, right?
Yeah.
So there is something to be said for Free as the pauper motif that Julian and Erica share. Because Julian and Erica spend a lot of the movie together.
Yeah.
I think that Julian and Erica might have more screen time in the same shot than Erica and Annalise.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
But yeah, to Be a Princess does come back as the reprise later on in the movie, but I don't think it's ever really associated with Julian in the same way that Free is associated with Erica and Girl Like You is associated with Annalise. Obviously, the How Can I Refuse motif is Preminger's motif.
Yeah, yeah.
That just tracks. Again, it's really interesting I'm going to point them out when they come up, but it's really interesting to listen for those motifs.
Yeah. Also, Preminger has this like... Yeah. He's got that one as well.
I want to say that one is more like a collective antagonism than just Preminger, because Midas also is associated with... I know that like Midas is associated with Preminger, obviously, because Midas is Preminger's dog.
Yeah.
But Madame Carp, I think, does get associated with that theme at least once. I think it's people acting with, like, Preminger's goals in mind.
The bad people.
Bad people.
Anyway, speaking of Preminger.
Speaking of Preminger.
The next scene after the song is, like, a cut to the mine, where there's a lot of, like, sounds of pickaxes hitting the rock, which is strange, because the mine was, like, supposed to be dry and, like, completely out of gold, and it seems largely abandoned when the camera goes in.
I think it's supposed to be Nick and Knack doing the mining.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what we're hearing there.
Yeah, 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 that's them doing the mine. I'm just, like, building up to that.
Oh, okay.
So that's where we see Nick and Knack, who are Preminger's, like,
lackeys.
Underlings. Yeah. Doing his work for him, like mining out the last few scraps of gold for him. Because we find out when Preminger comes into the scene, before that, they hear a noise, and I've written down here, Nick and Knack are voiced by Brian Drummond and John Robson? Rabson? I haven't written that A very well.
Yeah, John Rabson.
Brian Drummond is Canadian, and he was in Escaflowne. John Rabson was in Akira and Toy Story 3, but in no other Barbie films.
Mm-hmm.
But Brian Drummond's in a lot of other Barbie films.
I also found notable that Brian Drummond voices Hermes and Hephaestus in Clash of the Titans.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
A lot of the Barbie VAs in this movie were also in Clash of the Titans, fun fact. I really like Clash of the Titans.
So Nack picks up a rock and he's like, "Why did you put this in the cart?" And Nick's like, "Because it's a rock." And he's like, "We're only meant to mine gold, you
thunderhead."
Yeah, and he throws it away and the rock breaks and it's a geode with like amethyst inside. And that's going to come back later. And then they hear a noise and immediately jump in the mining cart because they assume someone's in the mine that's going to discover them. Mm-hmm. And we both noticed when we were watching that the animation for the minecart Jocelyn was really good.
Mm-hmm. And then we get our first on-screen glimpse of Perimeter, the advisor.
Oh my god, Mina, can you hear that?
Hear what?
It's the anti-Semitism train.
Oh. Yeah, man. And
oh my god, it's crashing right into the queer coding train.
Oh no.
And oh, there's a collision and everything's on fire now. And there's people screaming. Don't worry, I'm going to put sound effects in.
Yeah, so Preminger,
he's voiced by Martin Short.
Who is known for his roles in other children's media, such as his role as Jack Frost in The Santa Claus and as the Cat in the Hat in a few recent animated specials. He's more known for his roles in more serious media, I guess. It's all he does a lot of comedy, right? So none of it's really serious. Mm. I just know him from his roles in children's films. He was born in Hamilton, Ontario, which, fun fact, is where my nonna will drive to buy cheese every weekend.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's good my to fun hear. Fact about is Hamilton, it good Ontario. Cheese? It's good cheese. It's really good cheese. Oh, okay.
Nice. So, Preminger. Do you know what kind of surname Preminger is, Mina?
Oh, it's a traditionally Jewish surname. Julian.
Yeah.
Julian. Am I possessed?
Maybe.
It's a traditionally...
Oh my god, it's because you love me.
So, Preminger is a traditionally Jewish surname.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the family line for Preminger, as well as the original meaning of the name, have been lost to time. I wonder why.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you notice, once you realize that his surname is like a Jewish surname, all the characterization about him like starts getting really disgusting. So yep. For one thing, he's very lecherous and very sly and yep. uses underhanded methods to get what he wants. And he's obsessed with money and acquiring more wealth and more power. Those are all like anti-Semitic stereotypes used to dehumanize Jewish people across time. I really hope Furby Taxidermy is like enjoying this part of the show, because I do not like the fact that this movie was also really anti-Semitic. And outside of his characterization as like a greedy, lecherous, sly, underhanded, cunning, evil man, Preminger is also highly queer-coded because he has a lot of like effeminate body movements and inflections, and yep. he doesn't move himself in a very masculine way. He moves himself in a very like, "Oh my god, I'm so evil," like stuff like that.
He's very much what we would traditionally call flamboyant, right?
Yes. And that's also supposed to be like a marker of how bad a person he is.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't conform with the traditional masculine behaviors. So that makes him more evil and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I hate that about him. I hate the fact that they designed him in that way.
I just think that they could have gone like 2 minutes without making a Jewish caricature in a Barbie movie. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know.
They didn't have to make him darker skinned than Annalise, but they did. And they didn't have to like give him a hooked nose, but they did. And they did not have to make him greedy and, you know, like... They could have done this some other way. You feel?
I very much feel. I like his songs, but I don't like all the horrifying implications, as you put it last episode.
Yeah. Yes.
So get ready when the roses and stand by with the champagne. When you've got a brilliant plan, you never lose. Yes, before the tactical stormy vicar Charlemagne. It's a thankless job, but how can I refuse? How can I refuse?
it's primarily just like a solo piece for Preminger to just sort of evil around during. Yeah. And then Nick and Knack eventually come in to back him up.
Yeah. And like dance behind him.
And like dance behind him. Yes. A line in the song, the ermine coat. Where is it? Oh. And by marrying the princess, I get all that I desire, like a moat, an ermine coat, and palace views. Fun fact, before I did my research for this episode, I did not know what an ermine was.
What is it?
Okay, so an ermine is a species of mustelid, commonly called weasels, that have a white coat in winter. If you've ever seen one of those, go ahead.
So it's like when the kings wear the cape that has white fur with like black spots on it. I see. Yes.
So the black spots are little dots on the ends of their tails.
Aww, poor things. This is the animal cruelty part of the episode.
Yeah, so according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, they are also called the Bonaparte weasel, as in Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh.
And during the reign of King Edward III of England, only members of the royal family of England were allowed to wear ermine.
I see.
Fun fact.
That is very fun fact.
But yeah, as I was saying earlier, the motif from How Can I Refuse? And you're going to play it. It recurs often when the machinations of evil are occurring in this film.
Yeah.
Jason,
yeah.
What were your vibes on How Can I Refuse?
Okay, so I have a few notes here. Preminger tends to repeat the line, how could I refuse, a lot. It's like his theme.
Yeah.
So he says, it was waiting there, so how could I refuse, when referring to the gold and about the queen and proposing to her. And she just keeps saying that line a lot. He has this line in the song that I really like because it's so awful, but he says, even though she treats me coldly, it's a sign of inner fire. I really like that line because I hate it so much. Does that make sense?
Even though she treats me coldly, it's a sign of inner fire. For inside she's thinking, how can I refuse?
Yeah. Again, bad person, good character.
Yeah. And I really like this. There's a sequence where I'm going to put it in right now.
Yes, suppose the girl goes missing. So the king says au revoir. Then I find her, bring her back, and make the news. Then the queen will be so grateful that you'll pledge the girl to moi. And I'll humbly tell her, how could I refuse?
The camera turns to a wall, and we see Preminger's shadow dancing with the princess, Princess Annalise. And he's like, yes, suppose the girl goes missing, and the king says au revoir. And this is a shadow of, like, I think King Dominic.
Dominic.
Yeah, King Dominic, like, hailing goodbye. And this whole, like, with The Nightmare... No, not The Nightmare Before Christmas. Like with, what was the other film that Tim Burton made? Corpse Bride. When there's the exposition song about what happened to the Corpse Bride, like how she, with the shadows. Mm-hmm. This is also like a shadow thing. And I really like that. I really like the sequence transitions from 3D animation to, like, shadow imagery, which is basically just the 3D models turned into like 2D shadows on a surface. I really like that. Oh, I think it's a really nice sequence. And the music picks up in that sequence, which makes it more lively and nicer.
Yes.
And like Nick and Knack dance behind him with like pickaxes instead of canes. And then he jumps and like clicks his heels together. He's literally so evil. He's jumping and clicking his heels together.
Now, what I think is interesting is like, They had to tick the Irish box too, huh?
Oh, God. Jesus Christ. Yeah, but they don't sound Irish. That's the thing.
No.
Oh, God.
I just think it's funny how they associate the evil guy with so many persecuted ethnicities. You know what I mean?
This movie has a lot of subtext about that.
I mean, yeah, this movie is definitely about the maintained divine right of kings. Like, there's never any talk of Dulcinea or the kingdom that Annalise is about to become queen of. There's never any talk of any of them, like, becoming a democracy.
Yeah.
Like,
this is a very royalist movie.
Yeah, yes. Monarchist, rather. Monarchist.
No, royalist, because during the French Revolution, it was like the revolutionaries and the royalists.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize you were making a reference.
Also, it's worth pointing out that Preminger, he's not a noble by blood. He wasn't born into nobility. He was like a peasant or like a farmer boy or something. I don't remember exactly what he says. And he slowly rose to power over time. I just think it's strange to have that kind of character be a villain. Like, oh, he's not of the nobles. He's not of the pure royals. Like, he is evil because he used to be like... Well, no, it's not because he used to be poor, because Julian also used to be poor.
He's evil because he is a self-made man. He is evil because the nobility did not choose to rise him up. He sort of rose himself up and then was like, actually, deal with
it. I mean, to be fair, a lot of people nowadays who describe themselves as self-made are pretty... awful people, so I can support that.
Yeah, we're talking about you, Jeff Bezos. Eat the rich.
Eat the rich. We should definitely do that. While the planet is still, like, not on fully on fire, you know? The last thing I have to say about this sequence is when the movie cuts back to the palace, there's, like, this harp theme that plays, and it reminded me very much of the power plates theme from Prince of Persia, which I'm going to put in right now. Prince of Persia has a really good soundtrack. Anyway, you go on now.
Yes. The next scene is of Serafina, Annalise's cat, being chased by Midas, Preminger's dog, who we did mention earlier. So Midas is voiced by Jan Rapson.
Yeah, who also voices Knack, I think.
And I'm certain that everyone who listens to this podcast and is a human who is alive has heard the story of King Midas, but... just to recap it for, like, the Martians or Mothmen that might be listening, King Midas was, I believe, the king of Crete for a while there, right, Jason?
So here's the thing. I have no idea.
Jason?
I don't remember the mythology. I'm sorry. I remember he turned people into gold. He was the king of Phrygia.
Oh, okay. Okay. Mina was wrong. Jason, do you want to tell the story of King Midas?
Oh, God. Hang on. Let me try and remember it. So, okay. So this is going just 100% from memory because I have no idea what the details were. So there was this king who was called Midas. I don't remember how to pronounce the place where he was a king of in Greek.
I think in English it's pronounced Phrygia.
I literally have no idea how to pronounce that in Greek because I don't know how much of it is anglicized. I would have to see. I'll just Google it. Phrygia.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's Phrygia in English because we have the Phrygian musical mode.
Omidas of Asias is Phrygias. So. Anyway, so Midas was like this king. And he really liked being wealthy. He really, really, really liked wealth.
Yes.
I don't remember if it was a curse or if it was like a gift, but he begged the gods, I think specifically Apollo, but I'm not sure, to like let him be able to like touch things and turn them into gold or something like that. Or he slighted the gods and they cursed him. Basically, everything he touched turned into gold. And he was happy about that at first, but then like he couldn't eat.
He couldn't touch his children. He couldn't drink any water. He couldn't, like, embrace his wife.
And I think at some point he touched his daughter, like, trying to hug her.
Yeah.
And she turned into gold. And that's when he was like, oh, no, what have I done? It might vary from telling to telling. Because I remember this story from, like, a book I had that was, like, very beautifully illustrated.
Aww.
Yeah, it was a really nice book. Anyway, so Midas was really, like, sad about that. So she went to a river and started washing himself. The river did not turn into gold for some reason. And he was like, oh gods, I beg of you, please, please, please take this away. I don't want to live with like a statue for a daughter. And the gods were like, okay, sure. And then everything was ungolded and he was really happy. And I guess he learned a lesson about how too much wealth is bad for you. If the rich people of the world can hear this, too much wealth bad. But anyway, this is a very crass telling of the story. You should probably just go to the Wikipedia or like some website that has the actual story, because I don't remember it very well.
So TLDR, King Midas had a golden touch. He could turn things into gold. He turned his kid into gold. And realized that gold is a bad thing.
So Midas the dog in the Barbie film has a golden tooth.
Yes.
And he's called Midas because he really values the possession of this golden tooth as an item of status. The last thing I have to say about this is that both Midas and Preminger both wear a lot of like royal purple in their attire.
Yes.
So for anyone who doesn't know, I think we brought this up in like a previous episode. So royal purple was this dye that was made from like the shell of a snail that lived in the sea.
Snails.
Yeah. And
snails.
It was very rare to have clothing made from that dye, because there was like a very specific way that you had to like take the shell, crush it, then turn it into a dye that people didn't know. And it was like, it was a sign of status. You're wearing something that is really hard to get and therefore really expensive, but you're a king, so that's why that happens. Anyway, that's all I had to say, that their attire is also trying to show off how wealthy they are, because again, Preminger is obsessed with wealth and power, and so is his dog.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So Midas is a black standard poodle.
Ooh, okay.
he also has like a purple cravat around his neck to match Preminger's.
The royal purple thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just wanted to make it clear that the purple that he is wearing is like a terrifying dog cravat. But yes. So, Serafina is Kathleen Barr's second acting credit, as we mentioned. You may remember her from her roles as Aunt Drosselmeyer in The Nutcracker or as Marie and the Fairy Queen in Swan Lake. Jason, fun fact, the name Serafina is Hebrew for seraphim, which is a biblical name, fun fact, for the highest order of angels.
Oh, and that's Barbie's pet in this movie. Oh my God.
Jason, all I'm saying is that Barbie is the child of God and Serafina is like her heavenly watcher. That's all I'm saying.
It's also worth noting that Midas has a Boston accent for some reason.
Midas does not have a Boston accent.
He does. He sounds like Joey Wheeler.
Joey Wheeler has a New Jersey accent, you turkey.
Oh, does he?
Yes.
No, he's got a Boston accent, doesn't he?
No.
Okay, fine.
Babe, I'm sorry.
Okay, I've got them confused. There's too many Americans in the world. Never mind. Okay, so Midas has a New Jersey accent, not a Boston one. I could swear it was a Boston one. Anyway, keep going.
But yes, so Midas chases Serafina around a room and she tricks him into biting something. And she's like, uh-oh, watch your tooth, Midas. And he has a quick moment where he just flips about. He thinks he lost his tooth and he looks in the mirror and he's like, oh, you better watch out, Serafina.
Yeah, and she's like, ha, I'm a cat. I don't have to care about you. I'm evil. I'm going to scratch your eyes out if you try to pet me. My friend has a cat and he's really weird. He hugs you and cuddles you and then he starts like digging his claws into your flesh the next minute. It's like, why are you like this? Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry for the sidetrack.
No, that's okay. And then the scene shifts to Ambassador Bismarck arriving with Dominic in the carriage.
But we don't know it's Dominic yet.
We don't know it's Dominic yet. We think he's a page.
Ambassador Bismarck, voiced by Lee Takar, also in a lot of Barbie films.
Yes. He voices Bibble, so we're going to be seeing him very soon. Mm. He joins the hallowed halls of Canadian VAs who have been in My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. He voices Snips, and he's also been in a bunch of anime dubs, you know. The huge, Inuyasha, Dragon Booster, Gundam, etc.
Yeah.
He was also in Martin Mystery, being Ian, and What About Mimi, which are a bunch of Canadian animated television shows. And then he was also in the animated Stella Luna.
Okay, what's that?
So Stella Luna is a children's picture book about a fruit bat named Stella Luna. Now, Jason,
is that the fruit bat you were wearing?
No, that's Gregory. But I had a bat-themed birthday party when I was like 3 years old.
Oh my god.
So.
Oh my god.
I loved bats as a kid. I don't know why. Oh, no, I do know why. It's because the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, where I grew up, had this bat cave in it. I loved going in there and like listening to the bats like chirping and like. Anyway, I used to love the book Stella Luna. And so it was very cool that he was in the animated version. King Dominic is voiced by Mark Hildreth for the speaking parts and Mark Luna for the singing parts.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, I'm not super into that dynamic. I'm not super into the speaking, singing, two different actors dynamic. I also feel like it could have gotten confusing in the booth. Like, we're getting Mark in on Monday for Dominic. Yeah. And then we're getting Mark in on Thursday for Dominic. And I'm just like, huh.
Do you think they laughed about this? Like, they met each other and they're like, oh, you're Mark? I'm also Mark. And it's like, well, I guess there's a reason why we got picked for the same character. It's worth pointing out that Mark Luna, the singing voice for King Dominic, doesn't have any other credits in his IMDb page. He's been in like two other things and like nothing else. I hope he's all right.
Yeah, he's a country singer.
Is he?
Yeah, he's a country music singer.
Oh my god, okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So Mark Hildreth, we should already know because he's the Prince voice for the classic Barbie movies. He did Stefan and Rapunzel and Daniel in Swan Lake. He didn't voice the Nutcracker, but you know, that's all right. He gets a pass.
We permit him to not have voiced Nutcracker. Everyone else, they're nice, but he's all right.
He was also in Escaflowne and Gundam, What About Mimi, and Clash of the Titans. He played Pan in Clash of the Titans.
Have any of these voice actors not been in Clash of the Titans?
A few of them. See, like, a few of them were either in the anime dubs and a little bit of the Canadian shows, or the Canadian shows and then maybe, like, one anime dub.
Anyway, can I say the thing that I want to say?
Yes.
So, as they arrive, I was wrong when I said that we don't know that it's King Dominic, because we know instantly.
Well, yeah, because he says, are you sure?
Yeah.
He says, King Dominic,
so Ambassador Bismarck says, are you sure about this, King Dominic? And King Dominic's like, I am. And it's like, what? The king? I mean, we can see his clothes are not very, like, regal. But they still look very, like, fine, if you ask me. Like, if I had that outfit, I would wear it all the time. Anyway, do you have anything else you want to say?
No. My thing is for later with this one that I was about to let slip.
Okay. So we cut to Princess Annalise.
Yes. So she's wearing her iconic pink dress and she's analyzing a piece of
gold. I was very, the second I saw this, I was like, oh my God, that's right. She looks at rocks during this movie.
Jason is a fourth year geology student and you can really tell when there's a part in a movie that is made for him.
I felt like this was like pandering specifically to my demographic of geologist Barbie movie lovers. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
Okay, so I have actually a complaint about this. So Barbie has this magnifying glass that she uses to examine this piece of rock that looks like very shiny and yellow. And she has like...
Iron pyrite.
And she has like various other pieces of the same mineral like all over her desk. And she's like taking a really long time to examine this. And looking at this, I was like, girl, this is the easiest mineral to identify. Mina, no joke, this is the first one they show you. To like be like, this is a metallic mineral for you to recognize instantly because it's just so easy to recognize.
Oh my
all
goodness,
the
Jason.
Time.
Jason, do you think that they did it on purpose?
Yes, they definitely did it on purpose because they're like, okay, so what's the first mineral?
Like baby's first mineral.
No, I mean like they did it on purpose for the children watching.
Baby's first mineral
like,
identification.
Hey, this is the first thing you'll see so that when they go and learn about geology, if they like want to learn about geology after watching this film, they're like, oh, I saw this first thing that I'm learning here in the Barbie film. That's so cool. I feel like that was their train of thought.
Mm-hmm.
But in universe, like, Annalise, what are you doing?
Okay, but yes. So there's a knock on the door, and Julian arrives.
Wait, Mina, I have more to say about this. She's not even, like, actually going through the motions that one would go to identify a mineral. She's just looking at it under a magnifying glass. There's other things you're meant to do to identify something. You have to take a piece of porcelain and scratch the rock, and like see what color the dust is. You have to take a piece of glass and scratch the rock against that to see if it can scratch the glass to estimate its hardness.
It's Mohs level.
Looking at it is also a part of it, but like just looking at it.
Hey, Jason, can you off the dome piece? Can you off the dome piece tell me what Iron Pirate's Mohs is?
I think it's like six or seven. Probably
good
six
job.
Though. Hang on, let me look it up. Glass is a 5, if I remember correctly. So it should be above that. Let me check. Yeah, it's 6 to 6.5.
Huh.
So I was right.
Oh, there you go. Nice. Good job, Jason.
How's this doing for your asthma, Jason?
So, as I said earlier, the motif from If You Loved Me For Me is kind of Dominic's motif. Mm. And what plays as Annalise and Julian are talking is the If You Loved Me For Me motif in a minor key. Mm. So it's like they're discussing Dominic and they're discussing him in a context that like resents his presence, right? And so musically, they connote that by giving us the Dominic motif in a minor key. And I thought that was really cool. This scene gives us Julian's first speaking lines. My beautiful son, my beautiful
what
boy.
What is his first line?
My beautiful plant boy.
Do you remember what his first line is?
No? Do you have it written down?
Yes.
Like, what are you, trying to quiz
yes,
me?
Yes, I do have it written down.
Okay, go ahead.
So when he comes in, you said the theme plays. And Annalise is like, hi, Julian, I've identified this as Iron Pyrite. And he's like, well done, your highness. So you see him saying, well
okay.
done. And he's smiling and he stops himself and says, your highness.
Your highness. Mm-hmm.
There's this added formality that feels like, oh, he has to like watch his tone to not be too familiar with her. And Annalise instantly notices and is like, whoa, what's with the formality?
Why the sudden formality?
Yeah.
So Julian is voiced by Alessandro Giuliani, who is probably most famous for his role on Battlestar Galactica, but who I know in my most recent memory of him as the Wolfman guy from Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. So there's that. He's also in the Limetown TV show, which I didn't know. Good for Limetown. Like, snaps for Limetown.
Wait, Limetown has a TV show?
Yeah, Limetown has a TV show, Jason.
The podcast Limetown?
The podcast Limetown. Mia's on the big screen, or the small screen, rather.
Oh my god, I didn't know that. Is it a good show?
Yeah, all of the ladies in my PNWS Discord server, they're all going off about the Limetown show.
Oh my god.
Apparently it's pretty good, but I also do just want to have a moment of silence for certain other podcasts whose TV shows haven't worked out.
Which ones were they?
The Black Teams.
Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because of how sad I am about the Black Tapes never coming back from a hiatus.
I never listened to it, but one of my friends used to, and she was like, yeah, I hated the finale. It was really bad.
Well, the finale was really bad. That's what I'm saying. They ended it halfway through where they had originally allotted the end of season 3 for where it was supposed to be. Shakes fist at God and also shakes fist at Terry Miles. Anyway, moment of silence for the Black Tapes.
Oh, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I've also written down that he was in The Magicians as well.
Oh, yes.
He played
okay.
someone called Sawbones. I have a question. Do you think Julian is a Latinx character?
I do not think that Julian is supposed to be a brown man. I do think that he is a little more tan than Annalise. So maybe he's like supposed to be Hispanic, but I don't think he's supposed to be Latino.
Well, Latino people can be like paler. They don't have to be like super brown.
No, I'm aware, but I don't think he's supposed to be racially coded.
Oh.
In the same way that
Preminger is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like I feel like in Mariposa, right? Mm-hmm. There's Prince Carlos. There's Prince Carlos. In Mariposa, in Mariposa.
Is that your
right?
Spanish like, accent?
We're aware that Mariposa and Carlos are supposed to be Spanish.
Jesus
and like
Christ.
Maybe Mexican. Like, we are aware of the fact that the characters in the Spanish fairy movie are supposed to be Spanish. But Julian is never, he's never really framed in that light. You get what I mean?
In my headcanon, he is.
Okay, well, that's valid. That's you. That's your headcanon. That's valid.
Anyway, back to the movie.
Back to Alessandro Giuliani really quickly. He was also on The 100. He's been in a lot of other Barbie movies, so we're going to keep an ear out.
Mm-hmm.
He was also the voice of L in the Death Note dub.
Oh my god. Jesus.
In the same
Christ.
Year that like a few of the Barbie movies were coming out, he was L in the Death Note dub.
I like Julian less now.
He was also in Ranma, so I mean, you know, he's got to get that like older anime dub in there somewhere. I really love Alessandro Giuliani's singing voice, may I just say right now. I feel like they could have gotten way more mileage out of him. Way more mileage out of his singing voice.
They could have, but he was meant to be like a side character more than anything else and a love interest. So there weren't a lot of opportunities for him to have more than one song, right?
Yeah, I know. I know.
Like, it's mostly going to be Barbie. Yeah. Because she's like the main
character. I just feel like Dominic got this like really beautiful like tenor solo that he had going on. And then Julian's was so like by the books, and it didn't really show any of his personality. I just feel like him and Annalise should have gotten like a beautiful duet to sing.
Yeah,
like,
that would have been
the same
nice
way that Erica and Dominic got a really nice duet to sing.
It would have been a really nice parallel.
Yeah, I just feel like Alessandro Giuliani should have gotten the chance to sing more in this movie. And that's that on that.
Yeah. Back to the movie, Annalise is asking him why the sudden formality, and it's because, you know, she's going to get married soon. And Julian tells her, oh, the ambassador is here. And then it cuts to the ambassador, right?
Yes. So we've got Dominic pretending to be the ambassador or the page. And he gives Queen Genevieve that gift for Annalise, which we later see she gives to her cat.
Yeah. I think that necklace is supposed to be the Swan Lake crystal.
They're very similar, yeah.
Yeah, because I remember Serafina was like wearing it and looking at herself in the mirror later in the film. And I think it's supposed to be the Swan Lake crystal. Anyway, keep going.
So Bismarck asks about the date of the wedding, and Queen Genevieve gives him a week, at which Preminger flips his absolute heckin' beans.
Next week!
Yeah, exactly. It's very suspicious.
Yeah. And there's a camera shake.
Yeah, exactly. And then in the next scene, like I said earlier, in the next scene, Serafina's wearing the necklace that Dominic gave to Annalise.
Yeah.
At least somebody's getting use out of it.
Yeah, because she never wears it, ever.
No, she never wears it. Julian and Annalise are speaking on the balcony outside of her room. Overlooking the palace gardens. And If You Loved Me For Me plays again underneath the whole conversation, but this time it's in a major key.
Ooh.
And I think that at the same time as If You Loved Me For Me was Dominic's motif, it is also sort of a motif. I mean, you can make the argument that all of the songs in this whole movie represent love in some way, but I feel like specifically If You Love Me For Me sort of represents, within the score, moments of, like, romantic tension.
I think...
You know what I mean?
So does that mean Preminger's songs are, like, possessiveness and, like, love of material goods?
Yes. Yes, definitely material love.
But at the same time, to be a princess is not about love, is it?
You could make the argument that to be a princess is about attempting to find love in the circumstance that you're
in. No, it's more like about all the rigorous, horrible rules you have to follow.
I think it's about making the best out of a bad situation. I think it's how you could spin that.
Okay, that's an interpretation. Continued in part 2.